Thank you, Ryan.
You're off to a good start. He forgot to turn his button
congrats
on.
Congrats to everybody who did finish the marathon or even ran the marathon. That's not the easiest thing in the world, so congrats to all of you who did that.
That's huge.
It is.
What an accomplishment.
Too. It was pouring. Yeah.
Although I heard that's better for runners.
A little cooler
and rainy.
Like rain in your face while you're on? I don't think that's fun.
Was it pouring?
It was at times, yeah.
Yeah.
Cools you off, though. It's better than it being 100 degrees.
It's definitely better.
Is it better, Mary?
I'd rather run in the rain than heat any day.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
But isn't
Not
there more chance of slippage
yeah,
in the rain?
Yeah, there is, but it's just, it cools you down.
Yeah.
You know? And it's
I saw Batman running out there.
Oh.
It may have been a guy dressed like Batman, Ryan. I don't think Batman was available for marathon.
So the other woman wasn't Wonder Woman?
No, that was Wonder Woman.
Oh,
she
I was wondering
it.
Why Wonder Woman was such a big fan of Venezuela. She had a big Venezuelan flag with her.
I just admire these people because over 4 hours, and that's a great time. So some people, it took longer.
Yeah.
Not good enough, according to Kevin Hart.
But, I mean, all that time just running.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine that. Congratulations to everyone.
In the past, Ryan, people from Kenya tend to win this race. Did that happen yesterday?
Oh, gosh. I had the names. Let me see who they are. I don't exactly know. I think...
Sir Mo won. He's from
Mo?
He's from Great Britain, actually.
Great Britain.
But I
guess if the Three Stooges were knighted, you'd hear that
called him Sir
name
Mo.
Thrown
Mo
around
Ferrar.
A lot.
The wheelchair winner was from Switzerland.
Yeah.
The woman wheelchair person.
Yeah. Was that the female? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because Tatiana did not win this year, and she's the American who has won the last 8 years from U of I.
Oh.
Yeah. The guy who won the wheelchair race, 20-year-old guy from trains at U of I as well.
How did Joey Chestnut do? Do we know?
Didn't know he was
80
running.
Hot dogs. It's incredible.
While running.
80 hot dogs.
Whatever he does, there's hot dogs involved. He just loves the hot dogs.
Steve Cochran say that people were eating pizza while running? People don't eat while they're running, do they?
Sometimes to keep your carb load going.
Yeah, I think he was talking about when you run like those mega races, like
the 100-plus mile ones.
The ones that Jen DeSalvo does. Yes.
Yeah, where she takes on four states at a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the
Why
time I
just
get through
drive?
Colorado. Yeah.
Mary, have you run the Chicago Marathon?
I tried to, but 2 weeks before I sprained my ankle.
Good timing.
On an acorn.
On an acorn?
Yeah,
really?
I rolled my ankle on an acorn 2 weeks before the marathon. I was so mad, and I've not attempted it since. I've run like 12-mile races. That's as far as I've gone.
This is the acorn season, I'll have you know, because this is when they're all falling on the ground.
I was on a prairie path, and boom, I was at like mile 17, and I rolled my...
And those jerk squirrels are moving them all around.
Speaking of jerk squirrels, I have to tell you a story. We've talked about this in the past. These squirrels are acrobats. You see them go across the tension wire. They never get electrocuted.
Right.
They go up to the very top of trees.
Right.
I was walking the dog Kona, and there was a squirrel chirping at him, and it looked like a teenage squirrel. It wasn't full grown. It wasn't a baby, but it looked a little on the smaller, younger side.
Yeah.
And
was it wearing an Ariana Grande t-shirt? Because that you have a teenage squirrel is what you have right there.
No. But Kona was trying to, like, stalk it, you know. Dogs go slowly to walk up on it. And the squirrel...
To pounce.
Yes.
Yeah?
And the squirrel was inexperienced because it kind of just stood there and let Kona walk up to it. And at the very last second, it ran up a tree.
Oh.
And then Kona walked past, like, whatever. I missed that one. And about 30 seconds later, I hear this splat. That baby squirrel fell out of the tree and hit the pavement, hit the street.
Oh.
So then I walked back because I was like, oh, God, what do I do? It got up and ran away, but I can only imagine the internal injuries that poor sweet thing got.
And embarrassment.
Yes.
Because
it did look around to see who saw him fall.
I'll do that.
But I've never seen a squirrel fall out of a tree before.
No, they're usually very good at that, at navigating that. They can figure out really quickly what they can stick to and what they can't stick to.
Granted, it was rainy, so the bark was possibly sticky, a little slippery.
Do you have time for a squirrel question?
Yeah.
I have a quick squirrel question. Why do they... Oh, thank you, Ryan. That was great.
That was me.
Oh, was that you? I just assume... I hear squirrel noises. I go, it's got to be Ryan.
She's got dolphins and squirrels down pat.
Those are yours. Why the herky jerky movements with the squirrels? Why can't they be a little more fluid in their movement? There's a lot of weird kind of, I'm going that way, nope, going that way, nope, back to the original way. What's going on with
that? They're neurotic.
It's got to be, right?
They're trying to avoid the coyotes, right?
They just move quickly.
Yes.
I mean, all animals do that when they're running.
But not like a squirrel is so... It's like you're seeing frames of a film. Like, its head is that way, its legs are that way. Now it's the opposite. Now it's moving that way. Now it's moving that way. Like, other animals have some fluidity to them, but the squirrel is just all herky-jerky.
Yeah, you are right.
I don't like it.
Maybe it's overload, sensory overload, because there are cars to look out for, dogs,
right.
People.
But even in a set, like a more pastoral setting, like in our backyard where...
No one's around.
Nothing's going to run into it. It's got the whole yard to itself. It still does that kind of weird, kind of unpredictable move.
Let's ask listener Dave.
Dave will know.
Why are they so herky-jerky, Dave?
That was just their nature, basically.
Oh, it's, right.
Their nervous system. They're wired differently.
They're like a chipmunk. They just, you know, they're always looking around, this, that, and the other thing. It's almost like they're paranoid.
Yeah.
But, it does look like that.
But when a squirrel falls out of a tree, it's just like a cat. It always lands on all fours.
I heard a pretty big splat. That sounded like
that.
A flank.
Then it'll go up the tree and does what they call a bark. Squirrels bark.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. And then that's where they're either really teed off or thank God I made it, you know. But they always land like a cat.
Why do you know so much about squirrels, Dave?
Squirrelologist.
Are you a squirrelologist?
No, I'm a, I'm a sportsman, so put it that way.
All right. you're very secretive about why, but I'm okay with that, Dave. That's
He's
why.
He's a hunter, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Squirrel hunter.
Yes. Some people may not like that, but what are you going to do?
So, all right.
That's all right. Okay. You do what you want, as long as you don't hurt people.
And then when you figure it out, when somebody's having bad luck.
Yes.
Even a blind squirrel finds an acorn every once in a while.
Oh, that's so true. That's what squirrel hunters say, Wendy. That's the credo of your squirrel hunters. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
I picture in Dave's den, he's got a bunch of squirrel heads mounted, and the tape that he hunted them. He just goes in there and smokes a pipe and looks at all the squirrel heads.
They're so little.
Yeah, they're very little.
There's one thing we've learned from Oregon Trail, that old video game. Squirrels only get you like a pound of meat.
That's it.
I mean, you want to shoot the buffalo. The squirrels don't really give you much.
And imagine the little tiny plaques that their heads have to be on.
It's almost not worth it.
I would mount the tail.
Yeah.
That's better
more,
than the head.
Right.
It's
That's
pretty
more exciting.
Cool.
All right, we'll take a quick break, and then there's more show. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and it's WGN. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Can I throw a compliment to Ryan Burrow? He deserves a compliment. Ryan, will you accept a compliment from me?
Yeah.
All right. For people who listen to the station, you probably already know this, but in the newsroom, every week is something different. They designate it as like apple picking week or bridge week, and then Ryan gives a report about either apple picking or bridges or whatever that week is, and this week it's like scary place week or something like that.
Yeah.
Haunted houses.
Haunted houses.
Well, we did haunted houses, and
your promo today was the scariest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, yeah?
It was so frightening. It was about a deformed kid and
The Jane Addams Hull House.
Yeah,
this is for those people who like thrills and have ever done any of these spooky tours, that's always one of the stops. There are some really freaky things that happen there.
Wasn't there a movie, The Haunting of Hull House or something?
The Haunting of Hell House.
Oh, I'm getting them confused.
With Roddy McDowell.
That is a scary movie.
That's really scary. Yeah, yeah. But honestly, Ryan, in a minute... You had me petrified.
I'm sorry about that.
No, don't be sorry. I loved it.
So if you didn't get it, you didn't get a chance to listen to it. It'll run again at 5 o'clock. But Mrs. Hull, the original founder of the house back in the mid 1800s, apparently her spirit still lives in the kitchen. There's a woman in white who kind of stalks the upstairs, and then there's this devil baby. Apparently,
devil baby. Wendy.
Oh my God!
There's a devil baby.
An Italian couple dropped off this child who had a deformity. In 1913, there were actually a lot of articles written about this child. They didn't know much about it, but it was said to have an evil spirit in it, and then it just vanished one day. And now people who go by the Hull House apparently say that they can see the child in the attic window.
See? They have come a long way. When I was a kid, we went to Hull House, and all they had that year was Bobby Hull chasing you around.
He's scary enough, I'm sorry.
He can be pretty scary, don't get me wrong, but look at how they've grown over the years.
Yeah, and there's a fountain outside of it, and apparently if you sit at the fountain and listen to the cool breeze, you will hear three girls playing.
Isn't that
cool? Spirit of three girls, yeah.
Oh, Ryan.
Where is it located? I want to go see the Devil Baby.
It's on, what is that? Is it 600 or 800 Halsted? It's right next to UIC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why'd you have to say an Italian couple on this Columbus Day? And the Devil Baby was said to have pointed ears, horns, and scale-covered skin and a tail.
Yeah, people would come from miles around to see this thing. Yeah.
Poor thing.
Did they call the Devil Baby to its face? Yeah. Come here, Devil Baby.
Beelzebub.
It's a different time.
That was his name.
Beelzebub.
Beelzebub.
And I think it was referred to because that's the only context they had. Remember, the Hull House took in a lot of immigrant families.
Right.
They were trying to integrate them into this, into the community, into Chicago. So an Italian couple says, we can't handle this baby.
We can't handle this Devil Baby.
After being taken in by Jane Addams, staff members of the house reportedly took the Devil Baby to be baptized. During the ceremony, the baby supposedly escaped from the priest and began dancing and laughing.
That's what a Devil Baby does.
Not knowing what else to do with the child, Jane kept it locked in the attic of the house where it later died.
Oh. That's a sad
That sounds like neglect right
baby.
There. For
That's
all the people she's helped, that doesn't sound like something Jane Addams would do.
That was a cold Jane Addams right there.
Well, it was a Devil Baby, guys.
I know, but even with a Devil Baby, you got to take care of a Devil Baby.
That's, what do they eat? Goats? That's the whole goat curse.
I was going to say Apple Jacks, and you said goats.
Apple Jacks.
I don't know why, but Apple Jacks seems like something a Devil Baby would enjoy.
The spicy cinnamon flavor, maybe.
What do you want for breakfast, Devil Baby? More Apple Jacks?
Red Hot
Right. Stop spinning your head around. You're not going to get the Apple Jacks in your mouth, Devil Baby.
Poor thing.
We got some other fun ones coming up this week, by the way. But
More
Water
fun
Tower
than
Place,
Devil Baby.
There's haunted bars, the Congress Hotel.
What's called Water Tower Place?
Yeah.
That's haunted?
Yeah, go where Lord and Taylor used to be.
Let's just say it was the only thing that survived the Great Fire, and there was someone with it at the time.
Oh.
The Devil Baby.
No, it wasn't the Devil Baby. This was years before Devil Baby.
Was the Devil Baby the impetus behind Rosemary's Baby, or that was just completely on
separate.
Its own?
That's separate.
Because that was
it's
a Devil
similar,
Baby.
Similar, yeah.
This was real?
Like, what if this happened now? You couldn't advertise that you had a Devil Baby somewhere.
No, his name would be Phil.
Right.
Yeah, but you could post selfies of yourself with the Devil Baby. It would be very popular.
Hey, I was at the Blackhawks game. Who's that next to you? That little red guy. Who is that?
Oh, that's my Devil God. Baby. The Blackhawks game last night was giving me agita.
It was a tense game.
God. It was such a good game. We're ahead 2-0.
It didn't end well, spoiler alert, but the rest of the game was pretty good.
Yeah, but we got points. That's what I keep hearing, Jimmy.
They got a point.
We
got 1 points. Point.
And they're 3-0. I said, no, they're not. They lost. And they said, well, this is in regulation.
2-0-1. Two wins, no losses, and a loss in
overtime.
In overtime, yeah.
But
all three of their games have been overtime games, right? You get your money's worth when you go to a Blackhawks game.
And Jonathan Toews is back in action.
Yeah, scoring goals at will.
Patrick Kane.
The
oh, my
Devil
God.
Devil Baby.
He is the Devil Baby because he turned around and scored again.
I know.
And then they score in 19 seconds. What the what?
Yeah, that makes it very exciting.
And the goalie is from Elmhurst, if I heard that one more time.
Did they mention that?
At the very beginning of the game, though, Pat Foley did a great, he said something that they were passing so amazingly before the first goal or second goal. And he's like, we've got the Harlem Globetrotters out there.
Oh.
That's what it looked like.
Yeah, they're,
are back.
We're 3 games in, but they're looking pretty good.
Oh, so exciting.
I'll take 2-0-1 after 3 games. There's nothing to be embarrassed about there.
Amazing tribute to Stan Mikita
I heard about it and didn't get to see it. What did they do?
They had a whole retrospective of him talking about putting on the sweater, and you kind of take it for granted when you put it on every day, but then when you retire, you realize you miss it.
Right.
And right. Bobby Hull came out. Our new Blackhawks ambassador, Chris Chelios, was there. Savoir Faire.
Yeah. Mrs. Mikita, I'm sure.
Mrs. Mikita and her children and grandchildren. And it just, they had a touching montage. It was really great. And then they mentioned that the little number 21 patch is going to be on their jerseys all season. And then
a fitting tribute. It's well deserved.
It's just a little black disc of 21. It's
perfect. He played more games for the Blackhawks than anybody in history, right?
I don't know
think anyone else has played as many games as Stan Mikita for the Blackhawks.
He was so good.
Yeah. for so many years. Really, really solid. Yeah, that's a tremendous loss, but I'm so glad the Blackhawks are paying tribute to him that way. It was so deserved.
It was nice to see Chelly out there, too.
Yeah. But he looks like he could play today, doesn't he? He doesn't seem to age somehow.
Ow.
All right, well...
I'm the devil baby now.
All right, we'll be back in a minute. We've got a lot more show for you. Stick around. It's Bill and the Devil Baby on WGN.
Thank you, Ryan. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. Both Bill and I, big fans of The Walking Dead. And last night was the Season 9 premiere. You and I have been there. A lot of people jumped off over the course of the last couple seasons.
They said it was too graphic. And you said, not graphic enough. More blood and guts, please.
No, it was like zombie porn. It kind of was. Yeah. Like that. The zombies became the feature.
Yeah.
And, or walker porn, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
And now it's like they're strategically located. This is 18 months later.
Yeah. The zombies have, they've joined unions, which I didn't think I'd see, but they get better dental now. So good for them.
There was some sad news prior to the premiere that actor Scott Wilson passed away, who played Herschel Green.
Yeah, very sad.
Herschel's character, Scott's character Herschel, was just such a tender man, always trying to help someone. And we had him in the studio to talk about that. You were on vacation, so Steve Bertrand interviewed him with me.
Right.
He was in Cold Blood.
Yeah, with Robert Blake.
Yeah. He did other movies. He's had quite an acting career.
Well, the one that I've always loved him in is, and it's hard because it's such a difficult role, but he's George in The Great Gatsby. If you haven't seen or read The Great Gatsby, a pivotal character in the world of Great Gatsby, and he just played it so wonderfully.
And I felt bad because when he was cast in The Walking Dead, I didn't know from whence he came.
Oh, you didn't?
I really didn't.
He's been in so many movies over the years. The Ninth Configuration is a horror movie that he's in, a William Peter Blatty story. He had the most gentle, kind eyes of anybody I've ever seen on television or in movies. His eyes just took you away. He looked so worldly just through his eyes, you know?
He was such a sweet, soft-spoken man when he came in the studio. We actually got a zombified cake for him. It looked like a leg or a torso or something all bloody, and he just played along and was super nice. He is going to be featured in this last season.
Yeah, he filmed some scenes just before he died.
Yeah, and it was weird because you're talking, Maggie, the character, was talking about, I have to get back to Herschel, and I'm thinking, how are they bringing Herschel back? But there's a namesake.
Yeah, there's a character named after him now.
Which I didn't know.
Yeah,
I thought, wait, how do they bring him back for this? I thought it would be a flashback scene.
Right.
But really tender moment. And then at the end, they, of course, put the in memoriam. Although Talking Dead didn't talk about it.
Oh, they didn't. I'm surprised to hear that. I really am.
So, yes, Scott Wilson portrayed Herschel Green on the show between 2011 and 2014. He died October 7th after a battle with leukemia, and I believe he was 76.
Very sad. He was still doing fan conventions up until a couple of weeks ago. I just saw his name at a fan convention a couple of weeks ago, and everybody in the cast always had great things to say about him. They talked about how anybody new would join the show, he'd always give him a big hug and tell him that it's more than a TV show, it's a family. And welcome to the family. Really nice, welcoming guy. Yeah, very sad. The other celebrity death, and this is especially hard for those of us here in Chicago, Don Sandberg, who was on Bozo Circus, one of the original members of Bozo Circus. He was Sandy the Clown on Bozo Circus. He also died a short time ago. And very, very sad. If you ever went to see Bozo Circus, you always remembered Sandy the Clown.
I liked Sandy, although I have to be honest with you, I thought he was already no longer with us.
No, he was the last of the... You always say that when people die.
Is he dead?
I thought he died years ago.
I haven't heard
You should speak
from,
at funerals. That'd be great.
Well, obviously, I wouldn't then, but how old was he?
87.
God bless him.
He was 87.
Bill, he falls out of the limelight. I didn't realize he was still around.
Now, here's an interesting thing about him. After he was done with Bozo Circus here in Chicago, He went on to produce the Banana Splits show.
No wonder you're so aware of him.
Well, I'm very aware of him for that. The Banana Splits, other than the Beatles, the greatest music group in history. And then after that, he did a show which is similar to those shows, but different enough. Do you remember the New Zoo Review?
Coming right at you.
Coming right at you. Right. Do you remember the three? What were the three animals? Do you remember?
Was there an elephant?
Henrietta Hippo.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh.
Freddie the Frog. And Charlie the Owl. Those were your three animals on News or Review.
Was that on for a long time? Because I vaguely remember.
That was only on for 2 years. And the stories that always came out were that the actors who played those characters didn't get along. So, much like the Banana Splits, you know how they were always just banging into each other and they'd hear boing and they'd bounce off each other? Well, the actors who played those characters on News or Review went out of their way to hit each other very hard because they didn't like each other, which I think adds to the mystique of the show because nothing else was funny about the show. So, at least they had that going for them.
This will remind people.
Let's see. Yeah.
Wow, this is Doug and really Emmy Joe. It's antiquated.
Awful. Oh, it's awful. When you see the Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, he's railing against shows like the Banana Splits. They show clips of the Banana Splits, and they show Soupy Sales Show, where everybody's
Didn't
just
that getting, hurt your heart when he was...
Well, I already knew his feelings about those shows, but you realize that TV at the time, and to some extent today, was just a babysitter.
Yeah.
I mean, parents would just put the TV on and they plunk their kids down and they would just see cartoon characters hitting each other and bumping off each other. And Mr. Rogers, to his credit, wanted something a little more thought-provoking, and that's why Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood came along. But Don Sandberg, as part of my tribute, was a part of all three of those shows, Bozo Circus, Banana Splits, and the News or Review. It's quite a legacy.
That is. I loved Sandy the Clown.
Yeah. He was the mute clown. Mm-hmm. He never spoke. Now, I remember as a kid seeing this on TV, and I thought I was the only one who remembered this, but there was this thing where, remember on the grand prize game, you could only put your feet behind bucket number one, and then you'd have to throw the ping pong ball to bucket number two, three, four, five, and six?
Yes.
Well, Sandy the Clown comes up when nobody's looking, and he stands at the Bozo buckets, and he gets the ball in number one, and then his body tilts, to bucket number two, and then he gets the ball back, and his body tilts even more to bucket number three. So obviously there's some kind of visual effect, but when you're four and you're watching this, you don't understand it, and I thought he somehow had the ability to make his body just like move down toward the buckets. So for years I would tell people about that, and they're like, you imagine that. That never happened. And then in college I was telling that story, and this guy that I met in college goes, oh my God, you saw that? And I went, yeah. He goes, I thought I imagined that. I didn't think it's possible.
His clown makeup, in my opinion, reminded me of Red Skelton a little bit.
Yeah, it was similar. It was similar to Red Skelton's.
He was the last surviving original cast member of Bozo Circus.
Yeah. Now, people who hear that will go, what about Marshall Brodeen, who played Wizzo? He's still with us, but he was not one of the original clowns on Bozo Circus. He came years later. Because that's the first thing I thought. He couldn't be the last original. Marshall Brodeen is still around, but no, he came, I think, 4 or 5 years in to Bozo Circus.
Did you have TV magic cards? Because I did.
Yeah.
I was pretty good at them.
Yeah. Tap the deck. They all changed your card.
Love it.
It's a miracle. All right. We'll take a quick break, and then there's more show. Stay here, Bill and Wendy, WGN. There is a correction, just in the honor of truth, I said something about Sandy the Clown, and Jim has a rebuttal. Jim?
Yeah, how you doing, Bill?
Hi, I misspoke, didn't I?
Yeah, you know, you kept saying Sandy the Clown. I'm a little bit older than you guys, and I lived Bozo Circus. It was Sandy the Tramp.
It was Sandy the Tramp, not Sandy the Clown. Absolutely right.
Right?
Sandy the Clown didn't sound right to me, but I guess in my head I was thinking Andy the Clown.
Oh yeah.
Well, we're all there for each other, so it's okay.
Thank you, Jim.
I was actually Sandy the Tramp for Halloween one year.
Were
I was
you?
Little. I yeah? Not that kind of tramp. Don't look at
no,
me that way.
I know. I know.
Didn't he have a little stick with a bandana on the back carrying things? I remember.
he had a big hat.
And patched clothing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was a tramp.
He was a tramp.
A hobo, yeah. if you will.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, have a good day, guys.
Cut, but you're right, kind of in the, did you say the Red Skelton school of, yeah.
He looked, I mean, you know, Bozo had his own unique look. Cookie looked like Cookie. Wizzo was Wizzo. But Sandy the Tramp kind of looked Red Buttonsy to me.
Yeah, a little bit.
Almost.
Emmett Kelly Jr. in that school of clowning.
Yeah.
Tramping. What is the wrong terminology? There was a clip I saw this morning of Sandy. And it was during Bozo's red outfit phase. Whenever we think of Bozo now, it's the royal blue outfit phase. But for a while, he was all decked out in red, and it's always jarring to see it. I go to adjust my color, going, wait, Bozo wears a blue suit all the time. He doesn't wear a red suit, but yeah, in the early days, he did.
Well, poor Sandy the Tramp.
Yes,
that just sounds more so accurately. Derogatory, does it not?
Yeah.
Tramp, clown,
right.
I know
what you mean. I know what you mean. Really quickly, I was talking about the documentary about Fred Rogers called Won't You Be My Neighbor that you can see on Netflix. This weekend, I watched a documentary that you and I talked about a while ago, but I hadn't seen it. I don't know if you've seen it yet either. We were just kind of interested in the subject matter. It's a documentary called Three Identical Strangers.
I haven't seen it. Yeah, we talked about it.
I don't want to give too much away. But at some point in the late 1970s, brothers who were adopted by different families and triplets that had no idea that they had a brother or any siblings at all, through some circumstance, came to realize that they were related to other boys, to other brothers. There were three of them, triplets, yeah. And I thought I knew the story a little bit, but then as it unfolds, there's a lot of twists and turns that you didn't see coming. It's a really good documentary. It's on Netflix now. It's Three Identical Strangers.
I can't even imagine that being an experiment where you would separate these people unbeknownst to them. I mean, obviously, they had no say-so.
Yeah.
Does it explain why the parents gave permission for this?
Yeah.
Monetary reasons?
Not really. It's tricky because I want people to see it because it really is. It's a fascinating story. But I don't want to divulge too much. I have to be very careful because there's a couple things that I'm glad I going in because you just go, oh, wow, I didn't see that coming. There's a couple of those moments in the movie.
I would never forgive my parents. I mean, there's a lot of...
That's one of the issues that comes up a little bit is the brothers... They're not thrilled with that, but they're not that upset about it. They kind of understand it. When you find out the reason that it happened, it kind of makes sense almost.
You know, that's been on my mind. I've got to make, you can make notes on your iPhone. I have got to put down these things that I want to see.
Yeah.
I just recently saw Tully that was
good.
At theaters, and you said, Wendy, you would love this movie.
Yeah.
And I kind of forgot about it until I was at Disc Replay and saw it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I wanted to see it. So I have to get a list together of all the things I want to see. Three Identical Strangers, is that the name of this one?
Yeah, that's the name of it. Netflix has this thing as part of their website, though, where you can put things on
in your
hold.
Queue.
Yeah, that's what they call it. Yeah, in your queue. Sounds very British. Will it only accept British products in there, or can you put American products in there as well?
No, you can put both, but sometimes, I don't think Tully was available on Netflix. I had to go to another place
to get another source?
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's on Amazon.
Yeah.
So, but I should put some things in my queue.
Yeah, get a couple things ready and see what you're in the mood for.
But then my queue will be cluttered.
There's a system. There's a dusting system for your queue. It won't be cluttered. It'll be fine. You'll be fine.
And someone wants to know who Oliver O'Oliver on Bozo was.
Well, Ray Rayner played Oliver O'Oliver for a long time. WGN at the time had an interesting setup where their staffers did stuff in the morning, like Ray Rayner was doing the Ray Rayner show in the morning.
He was so unbelievable.
And then he would come back in the afternoon and play one of the clowns on Bozo Circus.
Those are like Tom Skilling hours.
Yeah, they were doing Tom Skilling
hours. Was he a clown?
No. Tom Skilling was not a clown.
I watch him every night. He has got to put himself in the shot. It drives me nuts.
He's not in the shot anymore?
No, he kind of moves out of the way of him, and it's like, I like to see him. I know he's showing the map, but Tom, we need you there.
So where does he go during that?
You just kind of, like, you know, he's in the shot and he's pointing to things. And
the
then
cold fronts and
just,
stuff?
Yes. And then you just kind of see, like, his it would be his right arm and right shoulder and half his face. Stay in the shot. I need my Tom Skilling fix.
Of course you do.
Sounds every like night. A bit, doesn't it? Like maybe him and Tomasulo are doing something where he goes off
maybe.
To the side.
Tomasulo should take himself out of the shot completely. Oh, I'm totally kidding.
Oh.
He's man of the people.
He is man of the people.
But really, please, watch the night news.
I've seen it, but he's always...
No.
I see him in there. You're not seeing him in there?
No. And I have a widescreen TV.
Adjust your H-hold. Maybe your H-hold is off a little bit. I don't know if TVs still have an H-hold and a V-hold.
I don't
think so. But he should, yeah, if he's doing the weather, he should definitely be there.
He walks out of it, and I need to see my
Tom Skilling.
Where does he go?
I think he's doing the weather with one hand and fighting someone off.
Fighting crime.
With the left.
That's what he's doing.
Trying to keep people off the air. Ben Bradley trying to get on. No. No. You stay back.
Not during the weather, Ben Bradley. I won't have it.
Who was Fraser Thomas? Did he do? Oh, he was Mr. Ned, wasn't he? Or no?
No, Ned Locke was Mr. Ned.
Oh, yeah, I guess that would be Mr. Ned. But Fraser Thomas didn't do anything else over there?
Well, he did Family Classics.
Right.
So
I remember that.
There was that. Bob Bell, for a while, when he was still Bozo, was also doing characters in the morning. He did a guy named Andy Starr for a while. Remember?
No, on the Ray Rayner introduce- show?
No, it was like his own separate freestanding show where he would introduce cartoons.
Oh, I vaguely remember that. Were you up early enough to watch cartoons on weekdays?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
That was better than school for me.
Well, yeah.
I learned more on the cartoons than I did on school. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then there's more show.
And coming up, the stories that matter with Ryan Burrow from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.
Thanks, Ryan. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. The 54th annual Chicago International Film Festival is about to take place here in Chicago. We'll give you all the details. ChicagoFilmFestival.com is your ticket source. But Patrick McDonald, a frequent guest and contributor to the show, film critic for HollywoodChicago.com is here. And Anthony Kaufman, Chicago International Film Festival's programmer, are both here. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Good to see you guys again.
Yep.
This year, bigger and better than ever, I'm guessing?
Not bigger, but
no,
better.
But better somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually cut down a couple days just to keep things more focused and better. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, quality, not quantity.
As someone who covers it, I applaud you on that, seriously, because it just, you know, you get to that point at the end of the two-week period, and you know, the energy is different.
Well, it's gone from over 150 films to 124 features. So we still got a lot. That's, you look through the program and you're like, how do I pick a movie out of the, you know, over 100? So it's
amazing. How do you pick a movie?
You go through the schedule or go online and you you start reading the synopses and see what excites you, what attracts you, because there really is a movie for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a Russian teacher, you know, there's something for you. If there's a, if you're from Cuba, you know, mm-hmm. or you have Cuban background, there's a movie for you. Mm-hmm. There, you know, we have movies from over 50 countries and just about every subject you can imagine. So
explain the process to us. Do they submit these movies to you? How are they chosen exactly? What happens there?
We have programmers who go to film festivals around the world,
yeah.
and we also have submissions, thousands of submissions that we go through our team of screeners. So it comes both. So we have films from like the best big film festivals around the world, Sundance, mm-hmm. Cannes, Venice, Telluride, kind of things like that. And then we get these submissions of films that no one has probably ever heard of, and we go through and we find the best ones we can find. It's just, actually, that's the most exciting part of the process. When you find a film that has not shown anywhere in the world, and you're bringing it to audiences for the first time. There's a film about pipes, the crafts of pipe.
Smoking pipe.
Yeah. A guy out of Michigan made the film about a Michigan craftsman, a great character, this guy Lee Irk. And if anyone knows pipes, I guess he's world famous. I'd never heard of him, but we're showing it, and it's great. It's a beautiful film. It's about more
all
than
handmade
pipes.
Handmade and everything,
yeah, yeah,
carved.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah. So who would have thought?
That's excellent.
Yeah.
That's excellent. What do you think is the most obscure of everything in this catalog? I'm going through the catalog. I'm blown away by the scope. What's the most obscure movie in here that you really think is going to make a difference when somebody sees it?
Vincent Minnelli's The Bandwagon. No, yeah. I'm kidding. That's a classic from the 50s. Yeah.
That was such an inside film fan joke. Sorry,
but Vincent Minnelli fans are going bananas right now.
Yes, that's right. Got to get tickets. You'll never see it anywhere else.
Liza just opened her eyes wider.
That is true. Like, you're a former film student, plus you just love film. Yeah. I am just your average film goer. There is going to be something for me as well, correct?
Yes. Well, you got to look at it on the macro level, I think. Do you have a country of origin, or do you have a country that you really
love?
I'm
from America.
You're from America. Well, there's plenty of American films.
There are.
But I always tell people, they always ask me for tips about it. I say, are you interested in the country? Are you interested in your country of origin? If you're if you come from the immigrant class, then go and see those types of movies, because it'll get a reflection of what's going on. You know, there.
That's good advice.
Thank you, Wendy.
I also
have some other good advice for you.
I program the films made here in Chicago. So, you know, that's a great place to start.
Yeah.
A great place finding to start. Films that reflect your city in a way that, you know, that you love. There's a great local movie by a filmmaker who graduated from DePaul called Olympia. And it's just about growing, becoming an adult. It's about a woman who's in her late 20s, and she's just trying to figure out her way in the world. It's a charming romantic comedy, really nice debut film, and, you know, reflects us.
It's also distributed by a local distributor who just started Cow Lamp Productions. So that's a real Chicago-based Chicago film.
If we're talking mainstream, your opening night selection is a really interesting one. Steve Carell's movie, Beautiful Boy.
Yeah, and Steve, that's a film that, you know, come Oscar time, is absolutely going to be mentioned.
Yeah,
yes.
The Timothée Chalamet, the lead character, heartbreaking
from
performance.
Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah, such a... He is amazing. He is going to be, you know, the
What's
big
this
star.
About, Beautiful Boy?
It's he, about his... Well, go ahead.
Oh, no. It is about the heartbreak of an addict in a family. And this is a upper-middle-class family, plenty of money to try to help him out. It's not anything below the dregs of society or anything, but it happens to so many families in this country. And Chalamet is just amazing as the addict, essentially.
But it's really about a father and son.
Yes.
That's what it's about.
So the selection to do this is opening night. What's the thought process behind there?
It's really good.
Is that all it takes? Yeah.
Yeah.
That
yeah. Should be I all mean, it takes. You know, it's like I said, it's going to be a part of the Oscar conversation. You're going to be satisfied by the movie. You're going to be satisfied by that emotional experience.
You're paying tribute to a director who was one of the hottest directors in America. And then, you know, as time went on, he sort of faded away. But people who love his work will always love his work. And that's William Friedkin. I guess best known probably for either The Exorcist or The French Connection.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. And he's Chicago.
Yeah.
Right? You know, he's from Chicago. So we came upon this documentary called Friedkin Uncut, which is basically Friedkin and a bunch of his buddies, you know, talking about his work over the years. And we thought, oh, we got to bring Friedkin back. He's kind of hilarious.
Is he?
Yeah, oh yeah. He pulls no punches. And he's not like pretentious, and, you know, he's like, look, it's a job. You know, that's what I'm doing. It's just a job. And and the way he makes the movies, it's all from the gut. And, you know, and he's still making movies, and he's directing opera.
Is
the guy who made The Exorcist is making operas in Italy. It's the weirdest thing.
One of the interesting things about William Friedkin is they always talk about the chase scenes in The French Connection, and the story goes is that some of it just kind of happened, that it wasn't set up, that they didn't tell people in New York, oh, by the way, we'll be shooting on these streets, we'll be shooting a chase scene. They just did it.
Yeah.
Very dangerous.
Yeah, and they almost hit some people.
Yeah, I know.
So funny, on the Chicago film tour, when we go underneath the Lake Street, they'll always say, oh, this is where The French Connection was filmed. It's, no.
Not really. Nope. We're talking about the Chicago International Film Festival. You want to go to chicagofilmfestival.com for ticket information. Patrick McDonald's here, Anthony Kaufman's here, and we'll continue this next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. We're talking about the Chicago International Film Festival. You want to go to their website, chicagofilmfestival.com. Anthony Kaufman, who is the programmer for the festival, is here. And Patrick McDonald, who I guess sounds like Jeff Garland, because we've got two techs wanting to know when the Goldbergs is back on this season.
I love Jeff.
Will there be virtual reality involved in this year's fest?
Whoa. Are you interested?
A little bit.
Whoa!
This is the first year we've added some VR to the program. Yep, we're kind of joining the 21st century. There are a number of big festivals around the world that have VR for the last few years, and I thought we should do it. So we got five projects for 4 days. It's free. Anyone can go to the theater, sign up for a slot.
You need to bring your own VR headset?
No. It's all there. Everything's there. All you need to do is show up. And there's the shortest one is about 9 minutes, and we have the longest one is 37 minutes.
Wow.
And you're in the headset.
Your face says it all.
I'm so confused by this.
It's freaky, man. It's
freaky. So is there a narrative? Is it done as a storyline?
Yeah. You're absolutely inside this thing.
That is cool.
They've had it at Tribeca. It's the most popular thing at
Tribeca. Could they one day take a film that's already been made and somehow turn it into a VR experience?
You want to be in The Godfather?
I would like
you?
To be in The Godfather.
Yes, the answer is yes. Yeah, they could.
How far off is that? Could that happen by Wednesday?
I mean, that's definitely going
to
come.
I have to say, the 37 minute one is, I mean, you're in this world for quite a long time. Most people I spoke with, they're like, 37 minutes. That's a long time to be strapped into the world, and everywhere you look, right, 360 degrees is this virtual environment. It's an animated environment. It's not realistic.
Yeah.
But it's pretty imaginative. It's really like being in
Animated film.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I'm so impressed by that.
I would be in Mad Max. That's what
would
I would like
yours?
To be in. Yeah.
That'd be the one you'd pick?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We should do that at the festival. Every year we pick one movie and put people in that.
So the practical usage of this is at some point when theaters do this is everybody will be sitting or standing in a theater together and see the same thing at the same time or not?
I don't think that's the way it's going to... I don't think that's the way it's going to pan out. I think movies will continue to exist.
Yeah.
Movies will be something we all go see, and maybe we'll have 3D glasses and kind of things like that. And then separately, maybe next to the movie theater, will be a VR kind of arcade.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, I think they're going to become more multi-purpose rather than just movies. You know, it's going to be all the visual experiences that people have now, which includes games and virtual reality.
Yep.
There at the festival this year, there will also be a tribute to the actress Carey Mulligan. Great actress. How did you choose her for this honor?
Well, there's a movie that she's in this year called Wildlife, which is an actor made the film, Paul Dano, who you might have heard of. It's a fearless performance. It's really strong. You know, I think we know her from films like An Education. She kind of plays sweet characters, and she really turns things around in this one.
Really?
Yeah. It's a really complicated character. Jake Gyllenhaal's in the film, plays her husband, who's kind of a loser, and she has to figure out how to survive on her own with her son.
There's another guy who challenges himself.
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
He's always really good.
Yeah.
A tribute to Colleen Moore. That's curious. How did you choose Colleen Moore? Who's no longer with us, right?
No, she's not. So it's a posthumous tribute. So Colleen Moore actually founded the first Chicago International Film Festival with Michael Kutz.
Did she?
She was living in Chicago, and they kind of hatched this idea together. So she is kind of one of the inspirations for the famous Chicago International Film Festival logo.
It's a combination of eyes, right?
Yeah, silent film star actress. So
Is she the one whose dollhouse is at the Museum of Science?
Yes, correct.
That's her dollhouse, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she's got a lot of Chicago connections.
Impressive.
Yeah.
She also was the one that made the connection for Michael with all the early stars that came into the festival, like the first 5 years.
Oh, really?
That's how they were able to get King Vidor and Betty Davis and things like that, because she had connection to those Hollywood people.
One other tribute worth mentioning is this is the first time we've tributed a costume designer, Ruth Carter, who did the costumes for Black Panther, which is like one of the coolest, coolest designs ever. I think everyone should get one of those.
It's going to be big this Halloween.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
There's no question.
Yeah. She's great.
Do me a favor, because is there 120 films at the festival? Is that about it?
A little bit more, but about that.
In that neighborhood?
Yeah.
One or two more that you really, maybe you've already seen, because I know you've seen a bunch of these already. Anthony, give us one or two, and Patrick, by all means, chime in, that you don't want people to miss, that you think you might not know the star or the title or the director, but you got to go out of your way to see this.
Well, I'm a huge fan of the documentaries.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites is a Swedish documentary called The Raft. And it's about a social experiment. It took place in the 70s. Anthropologists got five men and four women on a boat for 3 months to test his theories about the links between sex and violence.
Yeah.
Well, things don't go exactly as planned.
Oh. The Raft, it's called.
It's called The Raft. It's entertaining. It's interesting.
There
it's
must be some reason that the men outnumber the women. You don't have to say what it is, but there's a reason, obviously.
I mean, it is about violence and sex. Yeah. So perhaps more aggression, more testosterone on the boat. But it's actually it ends on a happy note.
Oh.
I'll let you know that.
Good. And Patrick, do you have one?
Yes. I'm a big fan of the British director Mike Lee. And he has a new film called Peterloo. He also did Secrets and Lies and Happy Go Lucky. So it's actually a portrayal of events surrounding the 1819 Peterloo Massacre, which is all mysterious now. But once you see the film, I'm
that
a
makes
big
sense.
Fan. Yes.
Yeah.
And how do we find out about the schedule, how to get tickets, where's the best place to go?
ChicagoFilmFestival.com. I urge everyone to look for a film you never heard of.
Yeah. Oh, that's good advice. That's very solid advice. Yeah. Patrick McDonald, film critic for HollywoodChicago.com, and Anthony Kaufman, the programmer for the Chicago International Film Festival. Again, you want to go to ChicagoFilmFestival.com. The information's right there. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. A break and then some news and then more of us. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Zorn, Zorn, Zorn. The greatest father in all the land. Zorn, Zorn, Zorn. We sing the praises of Zorn.
Eric Zorn is here. He's a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, but you already knew that. News-wise, Eric, this has been quite a week.
It's been a huge week, yes. I never get tired of that song, by the way. In case you were wondering, it's time to rotate it out.
play it so much, my son Michael learned how to play it on guitar, so he can serenade
you. Let's bring
you.
Him in.
And Eric, loot sales are up 30% over last year at this time.
I think we bring Michael in and have him do that. No, it's a huge week for news with the Kavanaugh news and then the Jason Van Dyke verdict on Friday. And I want to talk a little bit about that verdict, which is a lot of people are talking about. And I did a small column item for Sunday explaining why I thought that it was a legally dubious verdict, but one that was nevertheless satisfying. And people were saying, well, you know, what do you mean by that? And my answer to this is that you know, what happened here is in my opinion, is that Jason Van Dyke, the police officer, got out of his car and he just kind of lost it. Like it was like a lot of adrenaline, maybe testosterone, something. He kind of lost it and he saw this guy trying to get away. And he just thought that the answer to this is to shoot him. And once he shot him, he kept shooting him. He was in some sort of a zone, some sort of a trance. I don't believe for a second that he was afraid of Laquan McDonald, that this fear that he talked about on the witness stand is genuine. I thought that was all something they cooked up. You look at the video, he wasn't threatening the officers. He wasn't going toward... He wasn't angling toward Van Dyke. He wasn't swinging his knife at Van Dyke. He was clearly trying to get away.
And was quite a distance away.
He was 15 feet away, something like that. I don't believe for a second that he was actually afraid for his life or his partner's life or anybody else. He had his gun drawn. And I think that he was making that up because he was trying to build this self-defense excuse for himself.
Yes.
And that didn't work with the jury. And so, but to find second-degree murder, which is what they convicted him on, they had to find that they had to believe that he was actually in fear of his life, but that belief was unreasonable. So do you understand that? So they find all the elements of first-degree murder, and they say, but what he was thinking was wrong, but he was thinking it. Now, I don't think that they believe that. I don't think the jury believes that. From what they said afterwards about what their feelings about how he testified on the stand, I don't think the jury believes that. I certainly don't believe it. On the other hand, I also understand, as sort of a matter of common sense, that this isn't the kind of event that we think of as first degree murder. Like we think of first degree murder as something that's kind of depraved,
premeditated,
planned out, and has a selfish motive. We don't think of it as something that just sort of happens in the heat of the moment like that. And where somebody who's normally not going to do that, who's not a danger to society, Jason Van Dyke is not the kind of guy who's going to go out and be killing more people. He's not committing this murder in service of some other kind of crime. time. He's not, you know, this was something that people refer to it as a mistake, and I think that maybe is a too soft a word, but in some ways it does sum up what happened, mm-hmm. which is like that he did something that was really wrong, and he just exercised incredibly poor judgment in the moment, but he didn't do so for like wicked reasons or evil reasons. I'm not you know, you can argue whether it was racist or not. I don't think you have to enter into that. And so when you have a conviction that's lesser than first degree murder, that feels right, doesn't it? I mean, it feels like, yeah, he did something that was really wrong. He killed somebody he didn't have to kill. He didn't really have a good reason for it, but he just kind of lost his mind for 6 seconds or whatever it was, the time that between the time he got out of the car and the time he shot him. And so this conviction on second degree murder, which carries a sentence of 4 to 20 years, and then the additional counts of aggravated battery with a firearm, which
16
carries
of those.
16 of those, they'll probably be boiled down to either one or two. I don't think they're going to. He's not going to serve. That is a six. I think a six-year minimum. And I don't know what the maximum is on that, but
he doesn't have enough years in his life to serve.
No, he's 40 years old. I really don't think they're gonna multiply 6 by 16, whatever that is. Where is the math whiz around here?
I thought I heard it just counts like the first one.
It probably will just count the first one, from everything that I've heard, or the first one, or maybe the second one also. So when I've seen legal people talking about this online, and that there seems to be a sense that it's going to be, you know, more like 10 to 12 year sentence rather than, you know, 20 years. Or
he's
more.
Going to jail though.
He's going, and like I say, to me that feels right. Like this was something that he did that was really wrong. He didn't need to do it. And so the second degree murder, it seems like it was kind of a compromise.
It doesn't actually fit
the letter of the law. It doesn't fit what the jurors said, and it doesn't fit what I think they concluded. And if you ask them, do you think that he was really in fear of his life? I think they don't believe that. I don't think they believed him.
Police officers would have also opened fire on him if they felt that their lives were in
danger.
And
there were other officers with their guns drawn. You know, they didn't. They didn't shoot,
and then they helped him afterwards. They cooked up a story that made Van Dyke sound like he was behaving in a really dangerous way because they didn't know that the dash cam video was going to shoot.
Now, is there any penalty for that aspect of the story?
Well, yeah, three of the police officers are going on trial, I think, next month on a conspiracy to obstruct justice case here, because they clearly, to my mind, they clearly got together and said, well, you know, we're going to cover this up. So in a sense, it's like, I feel like this verdict is justice. I mean, it doesn't fit exactly the four corners of the law as I understand it, but it feels like justice to me. Like this guy, he's not going to lose his entire life. He'll probably be out of prison, you know, by the time he's 50, and chance to rebuild everything. He'll probably get this. I don't know how old his kids are, but he'll probably get a chance to, you know, see them graduate and get married and so on. And, you know, he'll get his life back, but he'll have paid a very, very severe penalty for this. And again, I mean, it seems like, it felt like a compromise from the jury, because the first-degree murder, he would have gone away basically for the rest of his life. I think the minimum on that is 45.
Was second-degree murder always an option, or was that something they tagged on toward the end?
Well, it was something that I think the judge agreed to at the end, after Van Dyke essentially made a self-defense argument.
Yeah.
And so when you make a self-defense, it's not in the original charge. Second-degree murder tends to be, you have to find all the elements of first-degree murder. And then second-degree murder is sort of a mitigating factor.
Didn't the jury ask if that could be a possibility? Wasn't that brought up later?
This was when they were formulating the jury instructions. This is something that the judge, I'm not sure if he did it by his request, whether it was his request. I can't remember whether it was the prosecutor's or the defense.
But it was added on. It wasn't original.
It wasn't part of the original charge. No, you don't charge first degree and second degree. That would be almost a contradictory charge. So they were allowed to give that instruction to the jury. And I think my sense is that the jurors went back there and said, kind of what I've been saying here, which is this was a really bad thing that happened. They probably had a sense of the gravity of what first degree murder means. They're not supposed to consider sentences when they do this stuff, but I think that, you know, you do. And they saw him, they saw his family, and they thought, you know, this guy needs to be punished. We need to make sure that he doesn't get away with this. On the other hand, do we want to put him away for the rest of his life for what was, again, arguably, 6 seconds of really terrible judgment that was not exercised for selfish reasons. It wasn't exercised for he wasn't depraved or wicked when he did that. In my view,
A few minutes ago, race came into this conversation for a second, and you said that shouldn't matter. If Van Dyke was an African-American police officer, if McDonald was a white kid, how do the elements in the story
change?
That's
a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. The other question is, what if Laquan McDonald had been, say, a drunk or strung out on cocaine white business guy in a suit walking down the street with a knife in his hand? Would he have been shot?
Yeah.
And I think the answer to that is probably no. But,
we don't know.
But we don't know. And for the purposes of the law here, I don't think you can say this was a hate crime. I don't think race played into it. The state, the prosecutors in their opening statement described Laquan McDonald as a black boy who was ignoring police, I think was the language they used. And then the defense attorneys came back and said race has nothing to do with this. And that was, I believe, the only real mention of race that came up in the trial. There was one African-American juror in Cook County, which seemed like a low percentage.
It did.
I was impressed by the interviews that I heard on this station and others with jurors afterwards, and what they said, how they explained their thinking. And because all along I was a little worried that they were going to be swayed too much by emotion, by sympathy, whatever. And there was definitely an intent on the part of the defense to put Laquan McDonald on trial, to make people think like, well, this he was a bad kid, like no harm done, you know, he's like he would have killed somebody someday or broken into your house or car. Yeah. I feel like that was part of they were going back several years saying, well, he was really aggressive with a guard at a juvenile detention facility. Like, really?
Yeah.
Still doesn't deserve to be dead.
No, exactly. Of course not. But I had the feeling that was one of their strategies, which was they wanted to say, well, you know what? Jason Van Dyke is out there trying to protect us from people like this.
Mm-hmm.
And he killed one of them, and so, oh, well. And the jury didn't buy that, clearly. They didn't buy it. In fact, I think I remember reading that at least some of them were offended by that.
Right.
By that approach. Like, they were trying to muddy him up. And again, so I was impressed by the seriousness.
They took their job seriously.
They took it seriously.
The animation also backfired, didn't it?
I think the animation did. I don't remember hearing what the jurors said about that. And certainly, as what I was ready for it to be, something that was really going to shed some new light on the thing. And what we're talking about is the defense paid something like $30,000 to have somebody do a 3D animation of the dash cam video, but from the point of view of police officers, from Van Dyke's vantage point. And you'd see him walking, and what you saw was what you saw in the dash cam video,
right.
was this kid kind of edging around the police, walking away, angling away from them.
He was walking away from them,
certainly not making threatening gestures toward them. And I think that backfired. I think they got this cartoon in it, and they paid so much money for it, they wanted to show it, but I don't think it helped at all.
No.
I'd be interested to see, you know, what as coverage goes on, we're going to hear more and more about this.
Eric Zorn is here from the Chicago Tribune. Stick around. More in just a second. Eric Zorn is our guest. You know him from the Chicago Tribune, or maybe you've heard him right here on this show every Monday when he comes in and he speaks whatever's on his mind. Let's talk a little bit about the Judge Kavanaugh decision.
Yes. I was disappointed, not surprised.
I was surprised.
Were you?
I really was.
Were you?
Susan Collins
I'm gullible,
comes up to the line, the Republican senator from Maine, and she gives this speech saying she thinks that Justice Kavanaugh now is not going to tamper with Roe v. Wade, that he believes it is established law. We'll see how that all goes. A lot of the commentary, I think we're going to have to move beyond the he said, she said aspect of this. I firmly believe that this incident happened, young Brett Kavanaugh engaged in this attack on this on young Dr. Blasey Ford, and I think that she was telling the truth, and I think it's possible that he was telling the truth, that he has no memory at all of something like that, given what we know about his drinking habits. I'm going to leave it at that, and I think the rest of us are going to have to, whatever decision we want to make about that, how we feel about it going forward, we're going to have to leave it there.
Right.
I also think that he lied under oath about things in his high school yearbook. I consider that to be consequential at the situation when the situation presented itself. But again, I think we have to move beyond that and ask ourselves, what what, you know, what do we do going forward here? The Supreme Court is an institution that really depends on its legitimacy, its sense that it is an august group of legal minds that are really weighing the U.S. Constitution against the modern dilemmas that we face, the modern questions, and that they are making decisions based on the law, not on their partisan prejudices. And this goes both ways, obviously, but right now we have, you know, all the conservatives and Republicans basically celebrating, you know, online on the media, you're seeing them raising a glass and they're toasting, they're doing a little end zone dance about how now we have this conservative court. I don't think that should be the attitude that you would have toward this, which is, I mean, you maybe deep, you know, when you're behind closed doors,
yes,
you can high five each
public,
other.
Not public, though.
But this public celebration that now the court is ours, now the court is going to rule the way we want it to. Now the court's going to be a conservative Republican court. The court has to be bigger than that, and I think that Justice Roberts, anyway, Chief Justice Roberts, recognizes that. And I don't know how that's going to play out, but I think it's going to be very important for the court to maintain its legitimacy and not have so many 5-4 decisions. I mean, there's so many of them are always, you know, you have the liberals lining up on one side and the conservatives on the other side, and that just can't actually be right. I mean, there can't, if the law and the Constitution says what we think it says, if it is as clear on some things as we think it is, we should see many more unanimous decisions. We should see the court having decisions that maybe surprise you but are based in solid legal arguments and don't feel like just partisan screeds. And
that's one of the most disturbing aspects of this. Everything about this story is disturbing, but the fact that the high percentage of people, just based on the fact that you're a Republican or a Democrat, you're going to vote just based on that.
Right.
That's so hurtful.
And there's so many important things coming up, not just about reproductive rights, but about guns, about voting rights.
Sure.
All these things are coming up. And if all these decisions are seen as simply partisan, you know, like,
right,
like the Republicans want them to vote that way, so they vote that way, then the court loses its legitimacy. It's not supposed to be another political branch. It's not supposed to be an extension of the Senate or extension of the White House. It's supposed to be its own majestic thing. And it's runs the risk of losing that when it goes so far into partisanship. So I'm hoping that as it goes forward that it's able to craft some decisions, that some of these judges will surprise us, that some justices will surprise us, that you'll see them voting together in a way that you wouldn't have expected, because they are smart people. They are all very intelligent scholars, and they should not be partisans. And I'm hoping that...
That's very idyllic, but do you think it's actual?
No, I don't. I mean,
I'm hopeful again. That's all I can
be. Are you really?
I have to be.
Oh, Wendy.
What else is there?
This is so naive.
What? No, it's not naivete.
Oh,
it's Jean Mate.
Yes, it is.
That's what it is.
I don't know what other way to be without being depressed every day. Seriously, I'm hopeful.
Okay, well, good. Wendy's hopeful. I'm glad to hear it. No, I'm not. I mean, I'm thinking that we're entering sort of a dark passage of jurisprudence here, that we're going to see a lot of these cases decided along strictly
just because it's Republican versus Democrat.
Yeah, yeah. And so you're not going to have these. And it's been, part of this is it's been this long game effort by conservative Republicans not to have people like, you know, David Souter, who was supposed to be a conservative. He's appointed by Bush, I guess, first Bush.
Can I ask you something very quickly? I'm really curious about, and we have negative 20 seconds.
Oh, okay.
If the senators' votes had been secret ballot, do you think it would have ended differently?
Good question.
That is a good question. Yes, I think it would have been a little different.
I do too.
I think but I don't know if it would have been, the result would have been different.
No.
But for instance, I think that someone like Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, the Democrat, who's in a tough re-election fight in a heavily red state, I think he really. Basically, as soon as Susan Collins said he wasn't going to cast a symbolic no vote in that case, he probably, if it's secret ballot, he probably would have said yes.
I think so,
I don't know, you know, but then there may have been some Democrats who thought that he was pretty good but didn't want to risk that, too. So
interesting.
We are really a divided country right now. So.
It's Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune. Thanks, Eric. We'll take a quick break and find out what's coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
And coming up, the stories that matter with Ryan Burrow from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.